Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read Luke chapter 18, verse 31 through 19, verse 10. We imagine the awkward silence after Jesus' followers once again cannot grasp the increasingly detailed prediction of Jesus' imminent suffering. We pause to think about the faith of the blind man who cries out to Jesus and wonder about the life experiences that gave him the faith and the courage to ask for what he needed. And we meet Zacchaeus, either a stigmatized fellow who's been ostracized from his community or a sinner who sees the light only after his encounter with Jesus. Either way, you've got to appreciate someone who will scamper up a tree for his faith. Thanks for joining us. Bobby.
Hey, Amy, how are you today?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
I saved a story for you.
Oh, God, I love your stories.
It's a story that I think is very funny, but no one else in my family thinks is funny. So I'm hoping that you're going to think it's funny.
Yeah.
So I have mentioned before these like parade of dogs. We have foster dogs coming into our house, and we have one right now who is grumpy, grumpy, grumpy foster dog. She's been, she's pretty new to our home. Been here for about a week and just really unsure of everything.
Yeah.
And so yesterday, though we had reached a general peace in the household, she all of a sudden decided that my husband was like a horrible axe murderer that she had never seen before in his life.
Yeah.
So every time he came into the living room, she would go bonkers, like barking and baring her teeth.
No.
Like I actually was like, is this dog going to run across the room and bite my husband? She didn't do that. So he handled it with great aplomb and started carrying treats with him. And so he would, you know, like squat down and give her a treat. And then suddenly they were best friends and she would follow him around the house.
Yeah.
And I told him that it reminded me of the portrayal of women in the, in the wisdom literature of the Hebrew Bible. Like either
that's
you're
awesome.
A misleading whore that represents, you know, everything that's wrong in the world, or you are the emblem of like wisdom and all the best things in the world. And there's no, you can't just be a regular person.
That's amazing. Cause yeah, I love, I love that. I see why people don't think that's funny though.
Yeah.
Cause you gotta be a little bit of a Bible nerd for that to be like in your wheelhouse. You know what I'm saying? But if you are, then it's very,
it's
very much in the wheelhouse.
Hysterical. So funny.
Yeah.
But we digress.
We digress.
We are in Luke chapter 18, verse 31 through 19, verse 10, which you referred to last time we spoke as the wee Zacchaeus. You had a song.
Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. He That's climbed beautiful. Up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see.
Is this a copyright infringement that you're
probably
seeing?
Probably. I don't know.
Probably not. That's got to be.
It's so depressing. We.
I know. We can't Zacchaeus, say anything.
You will never know how that song ends. It just ends the way the story ends. It's not a very romantic song.
That's actually how it ends. Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
So we left off last time at the end of chapter 16. Is there anything we need to know about what has happened between the end of chapter 16, where we left off, and where we're picking up towards the end of 18 today?
You know, the one thing that seems pretty relevant to me is, you know, Jesus has been developing this theme, or at least Luke has been developing this theme about riches and the role of riches in the way of God and in the kingdom of heaven. In chapter 18, there's a famous passage where a man comes to Jesus and asks him what to do, how to get eternal life. And Jesus names some of the commandments. The guy says, no problem. I do all of those. And Jesus says, well, then the only thing that's left is you need to sell everything and follow me. To which the guy says, no, I'm not going to do that. And the disciples say, who then can be saved? And so this that we've sort of established in that story that there is a barrier between wealth and salvation. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, going to become relevant in the Zacchaeus story. Mm-hmm. Anything else you would add in there?
No, I think that is the, I think that's the big one. I think that's the big sort of stepping stone that I would want to pull out. So I will pick up in verse 31, and I'm reading from the NRSV. Then he took the 12 aside and said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be handed over to the Gentiles, and he will be mocked and insulted and spat upon. After they have flogged him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise again." But they understood nothing about all these things. In fact, what he said was hidden from them, and they did not grasp what was said. So this is a familiar sort of trope at this point.
Yeah, this is the third time that Jesus has predicted his death and resurrection in the Gospel of Luke. And so those patterns of three are pretty important in the Gospels. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of third occurrence is the pinnacle of the predictions, I guess.
Yeah. And this one is so specific.
Yeah.
It really is. Much more than the last one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that he'll be betrayed, but handed over to the Gentiles. And not just that he'll suffer, but he'll be insulted and spat upon and flogging.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a general increase in intensity. Is that sort of what you attribute the increased specificity to? Or do you see more in it than that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important observation, is as we get closer, we get more details. And so it's sort of building, as a storyteller does, it's sort of building the tension in the story as we approach Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Some of these details that you're pointing out, like ridiculed, mistreated, spat on, and so forth, the argument, and I think it's a pretty good one, is that the Gospels are following Psalm 22, mm-hmm. which is a description of, you know, the psalmist is suffering and spat upon. And, you know, it goes like a lament psalm. And a lot of the details, this goes all the way back to Mark's original telling of the passion story, the predictions. But a lot of the details and the way that unfolds seem like he's kind of using Psalm 22 as a kind of a template for how to describe Jesus's suffering. And so that's what I do with those details.
Yeah. And, you know, I was looking back at Psalm 22, and it's a beautiful and heart-wrenching psalm. And it's just told from the experience of the person who's suffering. Like, it's an individual person who's suffering. I didn't see anything within the psalm itself that suggested you're suffering for someone else.
Yeah.
Right? It's a personal statement of really tremendous suffering, all kinds of suffering. Suffering of your dignity, suffering of your body, suffering of your spirit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
The question I want to ask, which I think there's probably a better way to ask this question, but, you know, again, the followers, like, I just picture them, like, staring at him, like, waiting for him to stop talking and then, like, awkwardly changing the subject.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is getting harder as he talks longer and longer and with more details about these things. They can't pretend they didn't hear him.
Yeah.
La, la, la.
I know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, do you make anything in particular of the way that their response is described here?
You know, the way that I kind of, at the end of the day, make sense of those kinds of claims is that one cannot understand the significance of Jesus until you've witnessed the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And so for the apostles, the disciples in the story, they are on the other side of the resurrection, and there's no way they can get it. They just, it was never going to make any sense to them until they see the resurrection. And then they can get it. So as readers of Luke, we can get it now because, you know, we know the story.
Right.
But as the disciples living through the events, it's just one of those things, you know, it's so far out of your framework for how you think the world is supposed to work that it's never gonna connect.
You don't have anything to do with that information. You know, I have this image in my head. I think it came from our old professor, John Hayes, of blessed memory, of having to, like, build new closets to keep information in. And until you built the closet to hold on to particular facts and stories and figure out how they relate to each other, it's like just a big pile on the floor. Like, you can't really do anything with the information until you have somewhere to hang it.
Yeah.
So I'm picturing our poor closetless disciples.
Yeah, no, I love that image. For some reason, the thing this is connecting to me with me is something like, it's connecting to me with climate change. And I realize that's kind of a weird connection. But like, climate change is one of those things that people have been telling us is happening for like 30 years.
Yes.
And people just cannot we cannot get our heads around it. And, you know, more recently, people have started to kind of clue in when you can actually see evidence.
Yeah.
But even people who are cluing in now, we're hearing about it for 20 years. And by and large, we're like, yeah, whatever. And so, like, it's to me, it seems like that sort of thing that is so outside of what we actually think is possible, even though the evidence is right there in front of your face.
Yeah.
You can't get your head around it.
You know, I really like that example, in part because I think part of the struggle with climate change is that, while yes, now we have some evidence we can start to point to, the system that they're talking about, like, is so huge.
Yeah.
And so I think it's almost impossible for any layperson to feel like they really have a grasp of all the things that contribute to a climate and can reasonably understand how all these things fit together. It's just too big.
Yeah.
And this too is too big.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Great. Great. Okay. Well, then let's move on and pick up in verse 35. As he approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard a crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." Then he shouted, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Those who were in front sternly ordered him to be quiet, but he shouted even more loudly, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stood still and ordered the man to be brought to him. And when he came near, he asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" He said, "Lord, let me see again." Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight. Your faith has saved you." Immediately he regained his sight and followed him, glorifying God. And all the people, when they saw it, praised God. All righty. We have had many healing scenes already in Luke. So what stands out to you about this one? Like, why do we need another, why do we need another healing story? Or where do you focus when you read this healing story as opposed to the others?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, oddly, even though you're exactly right that we have seen a whole lot of healing stories, this is the first narrated story of a healing of a blind man that we've had in the Gospel of Luke.
Hmm.
We've heard tell that Jesus heals blind men, blind people, but we've never actually had one narrated to us.
Interesting.
And then, you know, back all the way back in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus gave his inaugural sermon at Nazareth, he read from the book of Isaiah and said, "This has been fulfilled in your presence." And one of the things that was in that passage was the blind receive their sight. And we have not yet seen the blind actually receive their sight. So in one way of reading this is, here's the culmination of that thing that was preached all the way back in Nazareth. Now, I told you this was going to happen. Here it is happening. Like,
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that connection. I mean, one thing that stood out to me, and I'm sure we have seen this in Luke before, but it is not always the case in these healings that the person, the man himself, asked for healing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It seems important to me that here this guy is really calling out, is really putting himself out there and asking for what he needs.
Yeah, I mean, so this guy is he's a blind man who is begging. And so you have this physical disability that has led to his disadvantage in the world. And he's been reduced to kind of being on the street corner. And, you know, you can sort of conjure images being in Atlanta or even being in Little Rock of people doing this exact thing. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that he says, "Show me mercy," could be like, that could just be kind of what you say when you want somebody to give you $5, you know, or hand you a sandwich or something. So it's interesting to me, on the one hand, yes, he's asking for what he needs. On the other hand, I'm not as clear at the very beginning when he says, "Show me mercy," that he actually has "give me my sight back" in mind, although he might. But when Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" he's got the guts to say, "I want to see." Like, Jesus opened that possibility and he saw his moment and said, "This is what I want." And he wasn't afraid to ask for it. I think that's important.
I love that. And I love that because it's a connection. It's not just that he is asking something specifically of Jesus. He was already asking. He was already sitting at the roadside in some way asking for mercy.
Yeah.
And now he's able to sort of shout it out in the presence of Jesus.
Yeah.
I really love that.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting detail in this story.
Mm-hmm. The Son of David-ness seems important for him.
Yeah. Can you say more about, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I'm curious where you go with that.
I mean, I don't know quite. I feel like there's further to take it on the path than I have been able to take it. But, you know, so it has been, well, okay. So if we're assuming that this person who's begging is Jewish, which I guess I would.
Yeah, I think so.
It is understood that the Messiah is going to be a son of David,
yeah,
somewhere in the lineage of David. So this could be some acknowledgement that he sees that, you know, that he sees that connection. Now, of course, the word Messiah had a different resonance, you know, in the Hebrew Bible and whatever. So it doesn't necessarily mean that he understood with like a capital U, but that he understood that Jesus is the chosen one of God. That seems to me baked into that focus on Son of David.
Yeah, I love that. You know, Luke has talked about Jesus being in the line of David since the very beginning of the gospel. Mm-hmm. But this title, Son of David, has never been used in the gospel up until here. Mm. And so this blind man is the first person, including the narrator, Luke, to call Jesus Son of David. So I think you're exactly right. And I think that's important that somebody who cannot see in the sort of usual sense that we mean that is seeing deeply in this other more spiritual or more, I don't know quite what the word there is, but understanding the realities of things. When we've just had the story about how the disciples are unable to comprehend, here we have a man who has really no reason to comprehend. Like he's just encountered Jesus for the first time. He's not able to see him. And yet he gets it right away.
Yeah, right. Even after when he asks the folks around him what's happening, they don't call him Jesus, Son of David. Yeah.
Yeah, they say Jesus the Nazarene.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he applies that term, Jesus, Son of David, immediately, the very next thing that is said.
Right.
Why do you think that they tell him to be quiet? He starts shouting, Jesus, Son of David, show me mercy. And those leading the procession told him to be quiet. They scolded him and told him to be quiet. Why do you think they do that?
My first thought is that there's some sense that the way that we honor Jesus, like the way to show honor is to be orderly, is not to ask for things, is to, you know, that's what shows honor, and that shouting out and asking for mercy is not respectful in some way.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Now, I love that interpretation. Another very, very different way of reading what's happening here is that they're not scolding him about the show me mercy, but they're scolding him about the Son of David.
Oh.
And because the term Son of David would have been heard as a pro-nationalist messianic claim. You know what I mean? Mm. And so close to Jerusalem, close to the Roman authorities, close to the center of power, he's yelling, hey, y'all, Son of David, like future king on the way, everybody. Mm-hmm. And people are like, shh, like, stop it. You have got to stop that. So it's a political thing.
Because it's like would draw attention to them from people who would not want to see the future king coming into the city and maybe put Jesus in greater danger.
Yeah. So it's like a prelude to the procession that's going to happen next week, where Jesus is going to walk into the city and be hailed as king, and he gets killed like a week later.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of this guy tipping the hand about, well, here's who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. And so drawing the attention of the authorities. That's not in this text anywhere, but neither is the other thing, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah. What do you make of Jesus's statement, your faith has saved you?
That verb there in the NRSV has saved you, in the CEB has healed you, which has a very different ring to it.
Yeah.
The Greek is sozo, which can mean either one of those things, really. Hmm. But one of the things that it emphasizes is the sort of idea of being saved or rescued in Luke's gospel is not just about like the long-term effects on your soul, but it's about the immediacy. Here, I very much read that as, what is the faith that this guy has that has saved him? Mm-hmm. And it's the faith that recognizes who Jesus is, asks for mercy, and is bold enough to really say, here's what I need, and to believe that Jesus can do the thing.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that it's faith that was either demonstrated by, or I think even better, inextricably tied with the act of asking for help.
Yeah.
Like, I think the idea that it takes faith to ask for help is important here.
Yeah.
And I think many of us probably have experienced that it feels worse to ask for help and not get it than it does to just sit and suffer alone. And so it takes courage to be this person who needs help and and say that you need help.
Yeah.
Why this blind man believed it was possible, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if he had seen things in his life that would suggest that he could be helped in this way. I don't know. But then I also love the connection you made earlier to his, you know, his existence begging on the side of a road, that this was sort of all of a continuum in some way, that he has to maintain some faith that people will help, even if the kind of help he's envisioning isn't necessarily this miraculous healing, although that is great, but that it starts out with a more general ask for mercy and some trust that you will receive mercy.
I really love that so much, because I mean, it's easy to read this as like this poor guy. He's lived his whole life. Nobody's done anything for him. He's in desperate straits and Jesus comes along. But you've reframed it for me to know he's like lived his life. He has asked people, and out of, you know, the kindness of their heart or their sense of communal responsibility or whatever, people have sustained his life. And the reason he's here today is because of the kindness of people who are passing by. And that has sort of shaped him to have the confidence to ask for what he needs. I love that. That totally has reframed like his relationship to his community for me in like a really positive way.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's really interesting to think of that sort of all of a piece.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to pick up in chapter 19 with the story of a wee little man. He entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree. I'm sorry, this is so funny. To see him because he was going to pass that way. It's so weird. He scampers up a tree.
Yeah.
I mean, I am also short in stature, so I feel you, Zacchaeus. I just love that. I love the detail. I love it. It's so great.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love your response there, because like it's funny. It's a funny image, but you hear it so many times, you know, that you kind of lose the funniness of it. But this is a guy of like presumably like some, you know, he's wealthy. He's got some status. He's a dignified guy and he's climbing up a tree. Like, I think that's exactly the reaction that the people around him would have had. It's like, what on earth are you doing, Zacchaeus?
Yes. So in some ways, I feel like this should be a self-evident question, but what do you make of the description of him? We get just in the second verse what it tells us, not about what he does, but about who he is.
Yeah, I mean, the word that's used for Zacchaeus there is archetelones. And, you know, we've seen tax collectors previously, all the way back in the baptism story with John the Baptist, where tax collectors were instructed not to collect extra taxes. And we talked about in that podcast how there's like the tax collectors that are named there, telones, they work for like a regional tax collector who buys the rights to charge taxes for a certain service or a certain road or whatever from the Romans. Mm-hmm. So Zacchaeus is that guy. He's like the regional guy who's over all the other ones. And so, yeah, so he has presumably paid Romans for the right to collect taxes. The way he makes money is by charging people, you know, what the Romans are going to collect from him plus whatever the markup is. He's got other tax collectors working for him. And so, I mean, it's interesting. Like, people don't like the tax man. Like, if you ask people, you know, do you like the IRS? Everybody's going to say no.
Yeah.
Even if they think, like, taxes are a good thing that help us have a society, they still don't like to pay their taxes, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, this is an age-old thing that even if you have the best tax collector in the world who's doing everything by the book, nobody likes that person.
Yes.
And so Zacchaeus kind of falls in that camp. It also specifies that he's rich. And so he has done well for himself by collecting money from the people. And tax collectors also had a little bit of a reputation of being like pro-Roman in a way that made them questionable in terms of their commitment to the Jewish people as a Jewish people.
Yeah.
So they were very much invested in the imperial system.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. They're like working for the man and they're working on commission.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. You know, it's interesting reading this description here before I even really got into the story. I feel like by this point, the gospel has done a good enough job teaching me that the whole notion that there's like a category of people that is inherently more sinful than some other category of people is quite silly.
Yeah.
And that, and so I felt a little more of a sense of like, he's stigmatized, which is not to say that he might not also be sinful. He might be, but so are the religious authorities, you know, like it's more just sort of like a visible sin that has stigma attached to it, or the potential for visible sin that has stigma attached to it, as opposed to all the other things people are doing.
I think that's really, really important. So by the nature of what he does, he is assumed to be a sinner who is collecting taxes unjustly, even if nobody has any particular evidence that that is actually true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's important.
So it says he was not, let's see, he was trying to see Jesus, but there were so many people there that he couldn't because he was short in stature.
Yeah.
He wants to see Jesus. And the way that he can figure out to do that is to climb a tree.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about him?
Like, Zacchaeus is at least as eager, maybe more eager than anyone else we've encountered to see Jesus.
Yeah.
And there is a lack of dignity in what he's done here.
Yeah.
As you can tell by the fact that you couldn't get through reading it without laughing. And so he is willing to put his own dignity and what people are going to say about him, what people think about him. He's willing to set all of that aside because seeing Jesus is so important to him.
Yeah.
What else would you say about that?
I mean, I think the other thing that comes to my mind a little bit is, you know, so I'm trying to think, what did other people do when there was a big crowd scene and they wanted to see Jesus? Well, what they did was push their way towards him.
Yeah.
You know, and there are, like, I feel like there are other descriptions where the crowd is really, like, pressing against Jesus, like, physically overwhelming him because they want to be like close to him and they want to be able to see him. And he doesn't do that. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting, it's a really interesting thing to do, to both be able to see and show that it's, you know, important for you to be able to see, but also to be able to keep some distance.
I love that. And so you have opened up the possibility of a generous reading of Zacchaeus here, where he is willing to suffer indignities because he doesn't want to assert his kind of standing, or his, like, it's not exactly his standing in the community. It's his status in the Roman imperial structure. Yeah. He doesn't want to use that to his advantage. And so he's willing to take the indignity of scampering up a tree.
It has more for me like a sense of sort of curiosity than quote unquote faith. You know, like I want to see what this is without, I don't know.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
There's some distance to it. Like there's curiosity, but I don't know if there's more than curiosity yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Picking up at verse 5. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." I mean, Jesus not only knows his name, but has such a like pointed and specific and sort of like enthusiastic need to stay at his house.
Yeah.
In particular.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I want to say like, why, or what is the significance, or I don't know. Can you just like talk to me about that? How do you read that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to talk about this passage really, because there's two like totally opposite interpretations that are perfect. Possible in my head. Mm-hmm. And so like which way I think about it depends, like affects where I come out in terms of what is Jesus doing. But I think the most basic thing that one could say is, here is a guy who is Zacchaeus, who is alienated from his community.
Yeah.
And by staying with him, Jesus is restoring him to his community and saying, no, this guy's part of the children of Abraham. He's one of us. He's one of y'all. And so I'm going to demonstrate to you how you ought to be acting towards him, not distancing yourself from him because he's a tax collector, but being part of his community because he's a child of Abraham. And I think that sort of works no matter which way you read Zacchaeus.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I mean, I think I see it, yes, very similarly. Like, he literally is seen in the tree, but he's seen as a human with a really particular value. Like, he's not just, I went home with someone, this was the closest guy. Like, he is, Jesus calls him by name and, like, really singles out, I need to be with you. Like, I can't imagine, especially if you felt alienated already by your community, how it would feel to have a religious leader say, you.
Yeah.
You know, I choose you.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And I mean, and Zacchaeus's response is, it's interesting that you say there are different ways to read this, because I read him so positively, like, throughout. So I don't, but he's like, yeah, right on. And he, like, hurries down, like, he hurries to do the mitzvah. He is happy to welcome him. And then once Jesus gets to his house, he feels on the defensive a little bit. It's like Jesus doesn't even ask him a question, but he's immediately sort of making a case for his fairness and righteousness.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been gesturing toward these two possible readings, and I feel like that might might be relevant at this moment.
Yeah.
Because I think you're reading it one way strongly, which I think is an interesting way to reading it, which is not always the way that it is read.
Yeah, tell me.
So the common way of reading the Zacchaeus story is that Zacchaeus is a sinner. He's a tax collector who collects too much money from people. Nobody likes him because he's defrauding them all the time. He goes up the tree to see Jesus. Jesus welcomes him. And then Zacchaeus repents in verse 8 and says, here and now I will give half of what I've taken from everybody, and I'll pay back everybody I've defrauded four times over. Because, yeah, I've been collecting too much taxes. And so I change my life. And then that's what salvation means. In the last
Get
verse.
It.
The other way of reading it, which I think is the way you're reading it, is that when Zacchaeus says, I give half of my possessions to the poor, he's not saying, here and now I will give it. He's saying, this is my habit. Like,
yes.
I always give alms. I always collect what's fair. I always pay back fourfold. Mm-hmm. And what he's saying is, people think I'm a sinner, but in fact, I have been living righteously this whole time. Like, hello, my name is Righteous One, right? And so then if you read it that way, then salvation has come to this house is the restoration of Zacchaeus to the community, because people recognize he's actually a son of Abraham who has been living righteously this whole time.
Yeah.
So those are two very different ways of reading, like sinner who repents on the spot, righteous person who now is understood as righteous by the community.
I mean, I think the latter reading certainly presses, I think, in useful ways on our idea of what constitutes salvation.
Yeah.
You know, it's much less about the in this instance, this nuance of it is much less about your individual fate and much more about the healing of the community, of the people.
Yeah. Yeah. So the salvation in that reading is the one who was alienated because of the stigma applied to them by the crowd is now restored.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the crowd is also in that sense sort of.
Yes, right. There's a restoration like all together. And what really is restored is the community.
Yeah.
The wholeness of the community.
I love that reading.
All right. So we have come to the end of our conversation where we draw out some central points for our listeners. What is really rising to the top for you today?
I think the one that's rising to the top for me is comparing this story of Zacchaeus to the story of the rich ruler in Luke 18 who goes away sad because he can't give away his stuff. And one of the ways that that story in Luke 18 is read is one cannot have wealth and be a follower of Jesus. And this story of Zacchaeus really troubles that reading. And one of the reasons that this is important for me to talk about on the podcast is because I can be pretty hard on people with wealth and thinking like your wealth is nothing but a barrier to being a follower of Jesus. Well, Zacchaeus troubles that framework in, I think, a really helpful way, because Zacchaeus is rich, mm-hmm. but he exercises his wealth for the well-being of the community.
Mm-hmm.
If you read him in the way that I think you and I have kind of settled on, that even though he's got money, he is always fair. He always tries to practice his business in ways that are just. When he doesn't, he is willing to recognize that he's done wrong and restore, I mean, maybe double of what the law requires of him to even the playing field for anything that he has taken unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
Zacchaeus becomes an emblem of the fact that one, having financial resources does not have to be a barrier to faith or following Jesus. it often is. It, mm-hmm. In the case of the rich ruler in chapter 18, it was. But what matters is the proper use of one's resources for the good of the community. Yeah. That's what bearing fruit means. That's what John said all the way back in Luke chapter 3 in the baptism story. Like, what is bearing the fruit of the gospel mean? What does being a child of Abraham means? It means living justly in the community, not defrauding people. Well, we said at the time, like, that's actually kind of a low bar.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Zacchaeus, I think, is sort of bookending that. The beginning of Jesus's ministry is bookended at the end of Jesus' ministry, just by way of saying, that's what matters. Do right with your resources by way of community.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a message in there about stigmatizing people and assuming the worst of people when you don't actually know what you're talking about. And that strikes
people me. People never do that.
But I mean, ironically, like, I think I did that for, like, you know, 2/3 of my life reading this passage. I'm like, Zacchaeus, what a terrible guy. When, you know, I think this passage is not about that. This passage is about Zacchaeus is a pretty good guy. And I stigmatized him my whole life just because I'm like, tax collectors are terrible, you know? So it's kind of interesting to get drawn into that process, like myself, and then thinking about all the ways that I do that, like in my world.
You know, it's interesting that you sort of wrap up right there, because I told you after our last conversation that I was feeling like a really bad person, like a really inadequate to the task of what Torah requires of me, and you know, in the way that Jesus talks about it also. And so maybe also to escape my own discomfort with that. I don't know. But what's rising to the top for me right now is this idea from the second section we read today that faith looks like asking for help also.
Yes.
Like, we've been really focused on the obligations that we have to others to share our resources.
Yeah.
And that is real and true.
Yeah.
And when you ask for help, it's not just that you're giving your peer an opportunity to serve. Like, it doesn't just, I think the gospel would say you are helping out the rich person by asking for help. But it also is an expression that you believe in the world that the gospel envisions, and you believe it's possible, or it's coming, or it's here. And by acting that way, you help make it so.
I love that.
But again, speaking to the little Bobby that lives in my heart and tells me about faith, he's a wee little man.
The real Bobby is also a wee little man. And so it's like a wee version of
But that idea that, like, faith is not a statement of certainty.
Yeah.
It is an act that sort of moves the world closer to that vision. And if we all act as though this vision we're here and we're real, then that is actually what causes it to be real.
I love that. I love that so much. So share what you have, ask for what you need. Therein lies the community that both the Torah and Jesus are pointing toward.
It makes it sound so simple.
It does.
All the rest is commentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it.
So next time, we will be reading Luke chapter 19, verses 29 to 44 for Palm Sunday.
Yeah, the triumphal entry. That's a big day.
That is a big day. Well, I look forward to it. And thank you for a great conversation. And I'll see you next time.
All right. See you then.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We're grateful to all our supporters for helping us to keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest sponsor, Wade Wachholz.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Luke chapter 19, verses 29 through 44. Until then, keep on digging.